everyone, and welcome to Historia Canadiana. My name is Patrick, and this is the show about Canadian culture and the way it informs this nation's history. If you're already thinking to yourself that my voice sounds very different, it's because I finally got a proper microphone to record, which means no more white noise and sounding like I record in a tin can. After over 12 episodes, it took a world pandemic for me to finally get my act together. Anyway, today we're continuing our examination of an influential group in Canada's history, the Scottish. This time, we'll be focusing more on a written and social aspect of their impact, as opposed to the more traditional aspects of Scottish culture that we examined last week, that is, music and commerce and so on. So, if you missed last week's episode, why don't you give that a listen first, as you'll get much more context about who the Scottish were in general, why they came to Canada in the first place during the 18th century, and what some of the more recognizable aspects of Canadian life and culture are that they brought here. As for the episodes you're currently listening to, as the title that you might or might not have read indicates, we're going to focus on the somewhat less flashy influences of the Scottish migrations to Canada that the first wave brought, and talk more about the second one, which, as I spoke about at the top of episode number 12, took place roughly from 1815 to 1870. We're going to leave the Celtic language, ballads, and commercial endeavors behind. Instead, we're going to talk about something that we haven't really touched upon before in this show. Education. This will be the central topic today, but it will be brought about rather unavoidably, as you will see, through religion and the Scottish sense of social justice that was brought about through it, mostly through a Presbyterian ideal. We've spoken of social responsibility and religion before, both with the Scottish and with other communities like the French and United Empire Loyalists, but we've never really talked about how these would be brought about through a religious belief, which I think will be rather interesting. Finally, for good measure, we're going to bring in a few more literary sources that I know some of you listened for, and that were lacking in the last episode. See? If nothing else, I'm a man of the people. Finally, if you want to support the show, leave a review or check out the recommended reading list in the description. If you buy through one of the links on that page, there's a kickback to me at no extra cost to you. Anyway, on with the show. We left off last time covering various points in the first wave of Scottish migration to Canada, which was the whole time before 1815, and that mostly, though not exclusively, originated from the Highlands in a post-clearance period. In thinking about the second wave, there are some relatively distinct features as well. Highland emigration would continue to rise, but so would that from the lowlands. Both of these were mostly due to economic reasons, although they were slightly different. In the Highlands, on top of the classic desire to escape Anglicization of their native land, a famine would force many more Highlanders to leave in the 1840s, not unlike the Irish would do later during the potato famine. As for the lowlands, as historian J.M. Bumstead puts it, quote, "Agricultural improvement and industrialization created redundant populations." Boy, that sounds eerily familiar to our current situation. Now, that's neither here nor there. Doesn't matter. In essence, British North America provided an opportunity for better living conditions and economic prosperity and innovations for the incoming Scots. It is no coincidence that the first and second migratory waves are separated by the end of the War of 1812, which you can check out episode number 11 for more information about, shameless plug. This is a period when British North America, and especially the upper and lower Canadian provinces, were starting to recognize a sense of self and build a desire to create its own values and institutions, one that was inspired by the British model, but that was tailor-made to the North American context that Canada was intrinsically tied to. While elements of the future mentality of Canada would of course develop prior to the War of 1812, as we saw two episodes ago, the war pretty much awakened Canada's romanticized and nationalistic ideals. There is some contention as to whether that was deserved in the first place, considering the actual lack of any major consequences to that war, but ultimately, that is how the people living through that moment felt, and they acted accordingly. When the Scottish migrants continued to arrive in British North America after the War of 1812, their relation and desire for contributing to the landscape was inevitably altered in comparison to the previous generation, where the Scottish were still being recognized as a savvy and adept business people and hard workers that would help develop Canada. These qualities would be put to a different use, both within their own communities and within the grand scheme of Canadian society. Now, as permanent and influential institutions were being put into place that would shape how future generations lived, the Scottish were among those who stepped in to influence what shape those institutions took on exactly. But before we can analyze the impact of the Scottish on Canadian institutions like schools and such, we must first know what the Canadian context was prior to their involvement. I don't want to linger on it too long because it lasted for so little time, but let's start with education in New France, as it was nevertheless the basis of schooling in Quebec for a long time, even after the Scottish involvement in public education across the country. Professor Micheline Dumont from the University of Sherbrooke succinctly sums up New France education as follows. Quote, "In New France, education was the responsibility of the church, and its objective was Christianization. Instruction was an essential part of the early French missionaries' efforts to convert and acculturate the Aboriginal people. The different approaches used by the Ursulines, Jesuits, and Congregation de Notre-Dame, seminaries, schools on reserves, catechism lessons, met with limited success, although the missionaries made a contribution to Aboriginal languages by compiling the first native dictionaries. The children of the French settlers were taught to read and write as part of their religious education. At the same time, the social role of education was recognized, for the civil authorities established an informal system of bursaries, gifts, and land concessions that helped the main institutions to survive. Two levels of instruction can be distinguished, primary and secondary, the latter restricted to the boys. In accordance with the norms of the time, efforts were made to separate boys and girls in different institutions." End quote. So, we see a centralization of strict social norms that are enforced in New France around the ecclesiastical bodies, and while this is something that would only change very slowly under English rule in North America, religious influence on French Canadian education would remain much longer than anywhere else in the country. British institutions would continue to use religious values and educators as the foundational basis of the school system in Canada for the entirety of the country's colonial period and beyond. But non-religious groups did pop up in the mix. Whether it was organized by local churches or small private businesses, education in British North America was still not unified or centralized, though. This means that the curriculum would be different from Upper Canada to the Atlantic provinces, and even between one town and another within those same provinces. The small private services that worked outside of the church-led schools could take the form of itinerant school teachers, by which I don't mean that they were homeless, but rather that they traveled from town to town teaching to children privately or in groups, as well as schoolmistresses who taught from home. Within either private or denominational schools, education would remain segregated between class, sex, and race, everywhere in the colonies. Now, as the colonial era of Canada's history drew to a close, the push for a centralized public school system grew. This was mostly out of conflicting ideas about how and what to educate children about, especially when it came to the approach taken by different denominations and where they could teach. Remember, this is a time when there was still serious debate about which branch of Christianity was better across the world, and Canada was not exempt from this. And while Catholics and Protestants were to be legally tolerated by one another anywhere in the North American colonies, in reality, there were issues that arose. Protestant towns did not necessarily want a Catholic education to be offered, and vice versa. Furthermore, the desire for a globally accepted education made the need for a centralized system all the more necessary. The Scottish continued to arrive en masse in Canada with the advancement of the 19th century, just as the questions surrounding public education arose. This is where we will get into greater questions of religion and responsibility. I want to do this by starting to talk about a certain Thomas McCulloch, who on his own is less of a notable figure, but in what he represented and valued can get us onto the topic at hand. Born in 1776 in Ferenc, Scotland, McCulloch came to British North America at the start of the 19th century. Originally intending to head to Prince Edward Island, he actually ended up in Nova Scotia, in a small town. As if there were any big towns in Nova Scotia, let's be honest. But anyway, it's called Pictou. Thomas McCulloch was an ordained minister of the Presbyterian Church, specifically in the branch known as the Secessionists. This is a group that took off from a larger Presbyterian denomination of the Protestant faith known as the Church of Scotland. The differences are relatively unimportant here. They mostly separated over not being able to agree on a series of reforms and minor details here and there, or at least what we would consider minor details looking at it from a secular point of view. The point is that there are two groups of Presbyterians, with McCulloch being from the latter and possibly more open-minded one, although that's not saying that much at the time. The secessionists nevertheless became known as a more reform-minded group within the Presbyterian denomination of the Protestant faith. Presbyterianism would become a dominant element in Canada, mostly due to that massive Scottish immigration. Most of them were from that denomination, after all, whether it was of the Church of Scotland or the secessionist movement. Ironically, despite the fact that they were strongly associated with conservatism and an old Puritan style of faith, which led to many jokes at their and the Scots specifically expense, Presbyterians would be the most active in promoting reform, especially through what was called the social gospel. In short, in an era where new ideas were popping up left and right, such as Darwinism, industrialization, and a general criticism of pure biblical thought, the social gospel movement sought to move away from individual conversion in favor of calling for society as a whole to reflect what they saw as the proper teachings of Jesus. This led to some pretty interesting ideas, such as the desire to eradicate inequality and capitalism, as well as some more boring ones like social purity, which is a thinly veiled euphemism for sexual chastity. You kind of dropped the ball on that one, Presbyterians, didn't you? Anyway, that's just my opinion. Thomas McCulloch was at once a preacher, a theologian, and a writer. Putting those skills to good use, he established in 1816 the Pictou Academy. This was notable for being one of the few places to protest against the well-founded establishment of the Anglican Church's power in education that had been set up in Nova Scotia and in many other places in British North America by that point. In essence, McCulloch and his supporters wanted to be able to confer degrees and receive government assistance for their endeavors, neither of which they had. This became the central focus of many debates concerning education in Canada around this time. All educational projects were argued to need public funding, not just the Anglican schools. Furthermore, Dennis Kim of Douglas College writes in Boundless Dominion, which is an excellent study on Presbyterianism in early Canada, that, quote, Nova Scotia's expanding Church of Scotland contingent also proved reluctant to support Pictou Academy, a Presbyterian school founded by McCulloch in the early 19th century. The Scottish Church's reluctance to support the academy, which struggled to obtain reliable government funding, was largely due to the fact that it was perceived as a threat to their own fledgling educational institution, Dalhousie College. Aggravating tensions was the fact that secessionists were linked to the colony's reform-oriented political constituency, while adherents of the Church of Scotland tended to be Tories. End quote. Tories here being an older term for conservatism. We've touched upon it a few times on this show, but in case you hadn't listened to those, that's what it means. So you see really these problems that are starting to emerge and that really cause tensions within the Canadian society that's trying to form itself. But failing to garner significant attention through his school, McCulloch would not be deterred and would write scathing indictments of the colonies through the newspapers that were circulated in Nova Scotia at the time. including the Acadian Recorder, and ones that were started by his very own supporters, such as the Colonial Patriot. His most famous and enduring work would be called the Mephibosheth Stepshire Letters, not only because of their satirical abilities to comment very poignantly on the life and pressing social issues in Pictou and the British North American colonies, but because of what many scholars consider to be an influential type of humor that would continue to develop along a similar path in Canada, especially in the Atlantic provinces. We'll get to more on that a bit later in the show, but the Scottish and many of their desires to promote better living in the colonies would comment on it through comedy, so as to make criticism all the more palatable for wider audiences. A few critics, including famous scholar in Canada, Northrop Frye, have named McCulloch as, quote, one of the founders of genuine Canadian humor, that is, of the humor which is based on a vision of society that is not merely a series of wisecracks on a single theme, end quote. Now, I unfortunately cannot go into too much detail for the sake of time. I wanted to open up with Thomas McCulloch this idea that Scottish people and many of the Presbyterian faith would be proponents of a fairer and more just society. Now, of course, they were not the only ones to do so, as you will find reform movements from Catholics and other Protestant branches as well. But the likes of Thomas McCulloch were among the most vocal about this and most inclusive, and they displayed it through literature and debates around the state of education in Canada. What we are seeing here is a move towards that more inclusive society within British North America, or at least a will to. These changes take time, after all. With McCulloch, we see that the message expounded by the British Empire and its propaganda at the time, one that focused a lot on freedom and justice, is still in need of some fine tuning. I want to make a quick detour by looking at Alexander McLaughlin. I want to better describe how people like the Scottish saw Canada by the time the second wave of migration was in full swing, and what they saw their role as within that society, in a bit of a more concrete way that the sometimes vague and undetermined indications that the Presbyterians are kind of self-righteously talking about. This will provide a bit of a middle ground between McCulloch's early attempts at reform to practical ones being thought of, before getting into the aftermath and actual impact of this all on the Canadian social and education programs. Some necessary preamble, though, before we start this. There are some issues that I will be mentioning that relate directly to the 1837-1838 rebellions that took place in Upper and Lower Canada. I have upcoming episodes about that very important subject coming soon, so I won't concentrate on it now. All you need to know for the moment is that in the late 1830s, a rebellion broke out concerning the lack of a responsible government in British North America that was beholden to the people. For the Scottish, who were encouraged to come alongside other folks from the British Isles in order to quell these tensions by kind of flooding the colonies with supporters for the British imperial system, some agreed with reforms, as we have seen in this episode already. Others, not. The specific reforms to be acted out on different levels of society varied within different parties as well. What we'll see with Alexander McLaughlin is that a kind of middle ground between imperialism and justice was attempted to be struck. Alexander McLaughlin, who arrived in Upper Canada in 1840 from Glasgow, worked mostly as a farmer there before securing a job as an immigration agent that he got through his friendship with famous Irish poet and politician in Canada, Thomas D'Arcy McGee. His greatest and most recognizable influence was Scotland's national poet, Robert Burns, who we talked about last episode as a symbol in Canada of the Scottish heritage that has remained in more than one form. In this case, more of a recognizable form, right? Some figure that we can point to specifically as being Scottish. In fact, in mimicking Burns's style, McLaughlin wrote much about the brotherhood of common man and the life of the toiling pioneer. But, in true early Canadian fashion, he never quite made it to the poetic levels of his hero. You still get the satire, the humor, and the irony, especially against those that would be considered as excessive to or unnecessary in the assurance of a good continuity for society. So with this poet slash farmer slash government clerk, I want to present two of his poems, or parts of them, and show you what we can learn about the responsibility of the church and state to education and the relation to Canada to the British Empire. I want to start with one called We Live in a Rickety Old House, and read it in full because it's not that long and it's actually pretty decent, so it won't be atrocious for you to listen to. Quote, "We live in a rickety house, in a dirty, dismal street, where the naked hide from day, and thieves and drunkards meet, and pious folks, with their tracts, when our dens they enter in, they point to our shirtless backs, as the fruits of beer and gin. And they quote us texts, to prove that our hearts are hard as stone, and they feed us with the fact that the fault is all our own. And the parson comes and prays, he's very concerned about our souls, but he never asks in the coldest days how he may be off for coals. It will be long ere the poor will learn their grog to shun, while it's raiment, food, and fire, and religion all in one. I wonder some pious folks can look us straight in the face, for our ignorance and crime are the church's shame and disgrace. We live in a rickety house, in a dirty, dismal street, where the naked hide from day, and thieves and drunkards meet." End quote. In case that wasn't exactly clear, what McLaughlin is telling his readers here is that the condemnation of the church is justified in some respects. He treats the pious charity workers as if they were especially naive, and as such, fail to recognize that the failure of some men and families to make it in this world is that they were not taught properly by the church-led institutions, who are only interested in quoting scripture to the poor rather than educate them. He places the responsibility of education on the state, or at least the higher power that can enact change more easily within British North America. And you can see these kinds of poems arising quite a bit after the rebellions that I mentioned earlier, right? These ideas of wanting the destitute, the common Canadian, to be more recognized and to have a better place in Canadian society that goes beyond just what the British power tells them. And while the rebellions aren't explicitly clear in this poem, you can certainly extrapolate from a context that says, you know, these common folks are more important than you give them credit for. While by the time Alexander McLaughlin wrote and published this poem, responsible government was earned, there was still some issues in Canada concerning who had actual access to that power, and a lot of it was based off of these perceptions that the lower classes were not as educated or not as well informed about matters that really concerned the state. But that is not to say that McLaughlin found Canada to be a bad place. Far from it. If we consider a piece like Young Canada, or one like The Anglo-Saxon, which admittedly as a title hasn't aged that well, but we're not going to talk about that one, so it doesn't matter. I want to read a bit from Young Canada. Granted, this one was written and published in the 1870s, at the tail end of the second wave of Scottish migration. By then, the rebellions of 1837 had been quelled for over 30 years, so you might think that it is not exactly relevant to a discussion about changes in Canada. Well, I would argue that it is. You see, just because famous rebellions were put down does not mean that everything is going swimmingly in the country. Questions about Canada and its responsibility to its people were and still are today being raised in the country. And Young Canada is still an example of how that second lot of Scots came at these subjects, even decades later. So here's the first few stanzas of that poem. Quote, "I love this land of forest grand, the land where labor's free. Let others roam away from home, be this the land for me. Where no one moils and strains and toils, that snobs may thrive the faster, and all are free as men should be, and Jack's as good as his master. Where none are slaves, that lordly knaves may idle all the year, for rank and caste are of the past, they'll never flourish here. And Jew or Turks, if he'll but work, need never fear disaster. He reaps the crop he sowed in hope, for Jack's as good as his master." End quote. If we consider both poems I read together, we get a sense that reform-oriented groups were keen on getting things done, while still accepting the idea that the British Empire was a just and good place, as the official policy and propaganda said it was, where those who lived in it were all equal. Ironically, he still recognized that there were some rich folks that didn't necessarily work as much, and that immigrants, such as he mentions, Jewish people, were expected to work very hard and really have to live off the land while others didn't do much. He still understood this concept that while there were disparities, the British Empire was seen as this place ultimately of justice, where it would prevail in the end. It might be a little naive to think so. In fact, it very much is. But that is still the message that we're getting with these poems. But as we've already seen many times in the past on this show, and will continue to see very soon, even as we're understanding here with access to education being a bit more complicated than just being available for all equally, the British Empire had many kinks that it needed to work out. If you want to check out an example of this attachment to empire by the Scottish that is closer to the 1830s and 40s, as we've concentrated on so far, you can check out another writer from there called George William Gillespie. He's not as good, but it's still an interesting body of work to think about. You can check out the one called Canadian Woodsman's Farewell to His Log House. I'll post a link for it in the description where you can find it on the show's website. A more vocal and virulent criticism of the Empire and its dealings with Canada would be found around the same 1815-1870 period with the writings of William Lyon Mackenzie, another Scot who sided with and led the rebels I mentioned earlier. But we will have to wait for another episode specifically about the rebellions of 1837-38. Needless to say, that Scot's reforms were to take on a much more direct approach. I want to focus this last part of the episode on a man who we can analyze much in the same way that we did with Thomas McCulloch at the top of the show. That is to say, this Scottish minister is less important for what he did specifically, but for what he represented and expounded during his time, and how it worked within his context. Remember, folks, history is never about one single person. It's always about how people, places, and events respond to each other. When we focus on one element here, it's for the sake of simplicity and ease of understanding. Once I have covered this final writer, teacher, and theologian, we can once again extrapolate and talk about the advancement of public education in Canada as aided by the Scottish. George Munro Grant was another Presbyterian, this one of Scottish heritage, and born in the Nova Scotian area of Pictou County. Unsurprisingly, growing up in what was, as we saw, a hotbed, if you will, of religious debate and reform-oriented denominations, Grant would also become quite involved in promoting ideals of what he saw as Canada's destiny and responsibility to be a just and equal place within the British Empire. He actually attended McCulloch's Pictou Academy as a young boy. Today, Grant is better known for his classic work of exploration literature called Ocean to Ocean, which tells his tale of traveling the breadth of the northern North American land with Sandford Fleming. This will be the focus of another later episode, though, as it more or less fits within today's topic. It fits more within a discussion about Canada's Western expansion. Grant would be educated and gather a series of influences that would shape his view of the world and the role that education should take in Canadian society, which was fast on its way to Confederation by the time Grant was in his 30s. In 1877, Grant would secure an education job after having spent a good many years as a missionary and evangelist in Eastern and Atlantic Canada, where he would go against Alexander McLaughlin's criticism of the church and be aware of the plights of the poor and attempt to create meaningful social change within communities plagued by the endeavors of the rich. He took up a position in Kingston, Ontario, at Queen's University as a principal. It is during this time that his views would be allowed to be put into greater practice, and where he could try to have a more direct influence on how the younger generations could view the world in Canada. Writer David B. Marshall writes of Grant's opinions as such, quote, "He led successful endowment campaigns, promoted the rise of sciences, fostering the mining and medical schools, and protected the university's autonomy. In the controversies surrounding higher criticism, he argued that Christianity could withstand the challenges of doubt and reform. Critical inquiry led to a clearer understanding of Scripture. He rejected narrow dogmatism and schismatic denominationalism and supported church unions, anticipating a national church. A harbinger of racial and religious tolerance, Grant eschewed the politics of Protestant-Catholic antipathy and refused to get involved in popular Protestant crusades like the Temperance. He also opposed to exclude Chinese immigration. His progressive outlook was expressed in Religions of the World in Relation to Christianity, published in 1894, in which he pointed out that non-Christian religions had much to offer Christianity." End quote. Grant was very much convinced that history was a work of progress, and that we were, or always should be, striving to reach better standards, morally and otherwise. As we noted within the Marshall quote, this attitude is really the force that drove him during his time as the head of Queen's University. But what does this have to do with public education and Canadian attitudes in general? It's all well and fine to talk about one or two Scots and their dreams of equality and justice, but how does that translate to a nation as a whole? Well, this whole idea of wanting to unite various denominations, of promoting a more varied and modern education, as well as the drive to have the state fund schools and universities on a much larger scale than it had done in the past, all of which were foundational aspects of the Scottish and religious ideals that we've seen, really formed the basis of the creation of a public education system in Canada. Over the course of the mid-19th century, a state-regulated school system was gradually put into place in this country. This meant that, with the use of taxes paid by the general population, public schools would not have to worry about finding individual funding in order to survive. It also meant that, as the state regulated the overall curriculum, many things became a bit more standardized. The quote-unquote civility of British culture, the avoidance of American textbooks in the hopes of raising a national interest, and of course, a set of basic Christian moral values would be taught in most schools across the fledgling nation. Where Grant did not get his absolute dream, though, is in the lack of a national church that officially united many of the denominations in Canada. The Presbyterian Church would actually be absorbed later into the United Church of Canada, but that is just one of the many branches of the Christian faith that would do so. There are still Catholics, Anglicans, and a whole lot of other faiths from other religions as well, of course, although in the 19th century, they were not taken into account that much, or at all, since Canada was aiming to become a Christian country through and through, as befits destiny. Whatever, man, you do you. Jokes and opinions about Christianity and its place in society aside, there is something to be said about the will to create a more standardized version of education. It demonstrates a desire to coalesce a country into a more cohesive unit. The whole point was that no matter what social changes would arrive in the country's future, whether they were deemed to be good or not, and whether it was the ones that I spoke of today concerning greater opportunities or equality, there would always be a basic mentality that Canadians would be able to fall back on, should these changes fail to produce the intended results. It is important to note as well that the provinces of Canada and the various denominations would also continue to teach some of their views even after the drive for state-regulated education. Catholics as well as Protestant schools existed in Ontario, Quebec, and Manitoba for a long time, well into Confederation, and would even cause, again, quite a bit of debates, especially in Manitoba. There was this whole issue about French and English school, Catholic and Protestant schools, which hopefully we'll get to at a later episode. New Brunswick was even more localized in its variations, choosing to allow for instruction based on local communities. On the other end of the country, British Columbia would join into Canada with a single non-denominational system. So as we see it, and as we kind of touched upon with Grant, the school systems within each individual province and region still had a certain level of autonomy within this larger system. And it really exemplifies this idea of one being formed from many. Even if you want to look at it outside of a purely religious point of view, I would be remiss if I didn't at least mention James McGill in this episode. I touched upon him last time in reference to his commercial endeavors, but there is an obvious link to him and education as well. Upon his death in 1813, he chose to set a lot of money aside to establish what became one of Canada's best known and highest regarded universities. In 1821, McGill University was chartered and has been in operation ever since. So we can see this desire to strive for a better future among the Scottish, even in a university level, for reasons that, while not specifically denominational, were a bit inevitably because many people were at the time very religious, but they were at least not specifically Presbyterian or Catholic or Anglican. I want to conclude this with a statement of sorts. All of this shows us something. We tend to think of a nation as a single unit, a place that exists because of a mindset that most, if not all, can agree on as being good for the people living within it. What this two-part study of the Scottish in Canada has hopefully shown, or elucidated, is that this is a question that gets more and more difficult to answer for Canada. Yes, there are some influences that we can trace back to this population in Canada. Many of the more striking ones are, as we saw last episode, increasingly ceremonial. Some of them, as we saw today, are aspects that act in more of a behind-the-scenes capacity. What I wanted to showcase is that despite our understanding of a continuous evolution, either of Canada or the Scottish within it, that changes do occur, and conflicting ideas do play just as important a role in the development of a country that a single vision does. I chose to focus on the Presbyterian idealism of society for this episode. The concept of Scottishness took more of a backseat as I concentrated on the shape that culture prominently took on in Canada and British North America. The Scottish had an undeniable cultural and historical impact on this nation, as a people who brought to this country a sense that it could be better for everyone, and that equality is a value that should be strived for. While it didn't pan out exactly as planned, there are some aspects that did come to fruition. An education system that reflected a need for a just and united people to express themselves as one within the British Empire is certainly among them. But we also see the seeds of a multicultural vision, Canada, a mosaic, that starts to take shape even if it isn't recognized as such yet. The Scottish keep some of their identity even after having left Scotland for many generations. The ideas they brought here and their vision of society would allow for multiple voices to be heard as one. Does it go flawlessly into the future of Canada? No, of course not. We'll see as much very soon. But it does provide the means for an interesting thought experiment that allows us to contrast Canada with the rest of the world within its very specific North American context. Okay, that is it for this episode. Thank you everyone for listening. You can reach out with any questions, comments, or concerns on the Facebook page, through Twitter, and by email. All the links are in the description. As always, you can support the show through the Ko-fi page, soon on Patreon, and through affiliate links in the recommended reading page I set up. Finally, if you could leave a review on iTunes, it would be very appreciated. It really does help boost the show. For now, I'll just say that I wish you all excellent health, and that I hope you and your loved ones can stay safe in these intense times. I'll see you next time on Historia Canadiana. Cheers, everyone.